good. Okay, this, yeah, you've completed your business. Next, we'll move into the Finance Committee. Chairman Falcone, please call your committee to order.
Thank you, sir. This committee is now called into order. The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
Moved.
Hartman?
Second.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
First item is the update on Texas Park and Wildlife Department progress in implementing the Texas Park and Wildlife Department Land and Water Resource Conservation and Recreation Plan. Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chairman, there are no action items from the plan for us to discuss today or to present, and probably in the interest of time, I'm just going to do one thing. I think, as you recall, coming out of the sunset legislation, we were required at every commission meeting to provide a report on our internal affairs investigations in the agency, and so I'm going to go ahead and pass out that report to all of you. If you have any questions about it, please don't hesitate to contact either me or Major Graham Jones. And with that, that'll conclude my presentation. Thank you.
Okay. The second item on the committee meeting is the financial overview, and Mr. Mike Jensen, would you please make your presentation, please?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. My name is Mike Jensen. I'm the Division Director for the Administrative Resources Division. Before I get started, I'd briefly like to acknowledge and thank two of my staff members who don't get a lot of face time with you. Julie Horsley is sitting back here. She's the Director of Planning and Analysis, and she's prepared to address y'all on the statewide strategic plan as part of this session. And Lance Goodrum, he's the Budget Director. These are two of the directors that report to me, and I really appreciate what they do, and they do a lot of good work for the Commission. I'm prepared to give you a quick summary of the revenue and the budget status for the department. What we're going to do is we'll have a slide on state park revenue, and we'll discuss that briefly. Then we'll have a slide on boat revenue. Then we'll talk about the license revenue, and we'll look at where we stand with the biennial revenue estimate, the BRE. And then we'll have two slides that go over the operating budget as of February 28th. State Parks is pretty much almost at a break-even point compared to this time a year ago. They had a strong first quarter. Unfortunately, we had a poor second quarter, primarily because of the inclement weather. I think most of you are aware that it snowed all over the place. It was cold. And it was really poor performance in January and February. If you look at the first quarter, we were up about $819,000. But in the second quarter, because of the weather, we dropped about $885,000 down. So we're down about $66,000, but this does not represent the month of March.
You don't have spring break.
This does not have spring break in it. I was out fishing during spring break at Colorado Bend with a group of people, and the park was full. And what I've heard from Walt, all March long, the parks were full. So March should be a very strong month. And if we mirror the performance of last summer was a very strong summer for revenue, park revenue. With the rain that we have, with the lakes filling back up,
beautiful.
Hopefully we'll perform very well this summer with state park revenue, and we'll be strongly in the black. The only item that I'm hesitant to mention, but I will mention, is we do have a Texas Parks project that's going to implement hopefully on May 12th, and hopefully that will streamline things to make things easier in the long run for our visitors and for our state park staff, as well as for other staff who keep track of the revenue. It's a great system, but it's a very complex system. Scott Borff has done a great job at leading us and getting us to a May 12th go live date. And so far, what I hear, what I've seen on that team is that's very doable, and I'm looking forward to it going live. I think it's going to be some improvements across the board, and it's going to help.
Mike, maybe just for our new commissioners, Texas Parks is our new automated business system, our revenue and registration system that are being installed at every one of our parks. It processes all of our transactions, all of our sales, all of our reservations, all of our appropriate fiscal controls are built in. So this has been a huge, huge process that the agency has undertaken in partnership between AR and State Parks. And again, the goal is for this to go live in May, and we need it to function and function well. We're excited about the efficiencies we think it'll bring.
This slide represents Fund 64. The outlook is good. I think it's going to be strong spring and strong summer. At the next meeting, hopefully we'll have the details to prove that to you. Boat revenue is up almost 8%, or about $456,000. Most of this increase in revenue is tied to the fee increase that took place on September 1st for registrations. Francis Stiles, who oversees the boat revenue program, has compared 2008, 2009, and this year, and we are in the positive when it comes to registrations. We're slightly improving with titling, but we're still pretty far behind on sales tax. With the economy being the way it's been, the drought, people have not been selling boats. And what we've discovered recently, and this is the peak kickoff time for boat registrations, they're very busy in Building D and across the state with registrations. A lot of people who were transferring boats in the past year or two and with the drought were holding on to titles until they could actually put the boats in the water. So they're seeing an upswing in the number of problematic titling type issues. Texas has a very complicated titling statute, so people try to, I guess it's an avoidance strategy. They don't want to have to deal with that until they actually know they can put the boat in the water. But the outlook is good. The revenue is up, registrations are up, and hopefully if the economy can pick up, then people can start transferring and selling boats like they've done in the past. License sales revenue, I've changed the graph. In the past, I've usually just shown a comparison from the current year to the prior year, but I think it's important for you to see fiscal year 2008, because that was the base year that was used for the fee increase. All the analysis was done against 2008, and 2008 was a fairly strong year for license revenue. So when you look at this slide, you can see because of the fee increase that went into place in September, the revenues are actually trending and tracking upward. And when we compare to 2008, we're up. 2008 was $71.26 million. The current year at the end of February, $71.8, almost $71.9 million. I think that's a better comparison than against 2009. 2009 was slow because we started that year with a hurricane, and that impacted license sales, fishing license sales. So we are up compared by $2.81 million. And comparing to 09, but when you compare to 08, we're only up by 600,000. The only caveat I'd like to throw in here, I mentioned it at the last meeting, these figures incorporate more than just Fund 9 revenue. Most of these licenses are Fund 9, but the lifetime license revenue is not Fund 9. So if you pull the lifetime licenses out of here, the comparison against 09, we're still up by about 1.65 million. But if you pull it out and compare it to 08, we're down compared to 08, almost 639,000 behind 08. And most of that is going to be tied to, you'll probably see it in the next three slides, fishing license sales. The trends have changed over what they've been historically. This is a new slide that hopefully I can explain without confusing anybody. This slide is showing you a variance comparison from 2010 compared to 09 and 08, just on revenues. So what I'll do is I'll walk you down here and I'll relate to you what that percentage means in terms of revenue. When we look at 2008, that other, that's primarily lifetime licenses, because the spike that we had at the end of 09 and the beginning of 2010, that's significantly high. That's 14.91%. But that percentage of other equates to 1.24 million for 08. Resident hunting licenses in 08, 2.25% equates to, and we're above 08 by 374,000. Non-resident hunting, we knew that was going to be down. That was in comparison to 2010 and 08. We're about 11.7% down, and that amount is in the whole 214,000. Resident fishing, this is the line item that's significant to keep track of. Compared to 08, we're down 12.27%. In terms of funding, that's $1.68 million behind 08. Non-resident fishing, this percentage is negative 3.3%, but the revenue is only negative 64,000. The combination licenses are up 3.46%, and that equates to we're doing better this year than 08 to the tune of about almost 1.02 million. So I guess one of the questions is about the fishing licenses. Why are those performing poorly? I think the primary reason is going to be economy. The drought is a contributing factor. The spike in lifetime license sales probably is not, because the number that's involved, you'll see two slides from now. It's about 1,100 to 1,200 lifetime licenses that are probably displacing combination licenses. But in terms of the count of fishing licenses, 1,000 compared to about 75,000, there's a big swing there. So it's a small contributing factor, but the largest factors are probably just the economy and the drought. These figures are only through February, so hopefully they're going to improve as more and more people go out fishing this spring. Like I said, at Colorado Bend, the banks were lined, everybody was fishing. It was a state park, so some people didn't have licenses, but the people who went with me did, so we contributed.
Good work, Mike.
Yeah.
When we compare to 2009, this looks more favorable, but I think the better comparison is 08. When we're looking at the other, we're up 16.02%. That equates to $1.17 million. Resident hunting, we're up 3.9%. That is, we're $652,000 above 09. Non-resident hunting, 2.91%. That equates to $46,000 above 09. Resident fishing, 2.36% down. That equates to $290,000 behind 2009. And non-resident fishing, 3.79% behind. That means we're down $73,000 in revenue. And due to the huge volume of lifetime, well, this is combo. I'm getting confused. The 4.24% of combination, we're up. That equates to about $1.24 million. So overall, the outlook is good. And looks like the fishing licenses are picking up. We get a weekly report from Tom Newton, and each week we're looking at those licenses, and we're making good gains, but we'll probably know better in about a month or two to see how the spring season's picking up before we kick into the summer. This next slide speaks of the count of licenses sold. You can see that the revenue trend was moving up, but there's a downward slope for the number of licenses sold. That's typically the result of when you increase a fee. That's a natural reaction to that reality. So when we look at 10, we've sold 2.02 million licenses compared to 09, 2.05. In fiscal year 2008, that would be 2.1 million licenses. This slide is doing the similar comparison that we did with the revenue slide, that we're looking at the count. And this is where it becomes obvious that it's the fishing licenses are the main concern on Fund 9 revenue. And it also helps us see that the lifetime licenses, while they may be contributing to that, what they're really robbing from is probably the combination license. Those are people who probably would have bought a combo license, but now they don't have that need because they have a lifetime license. Most of the lifetime license sales were for the combination rather than just for hunting or just for fishing. So if we look at 2008, that other category, 3.32%, that represents 1,140 licenses. So that's a small portion of lifetime licenses in the context of when we get down to the resident fishing, that negative 15.23, that's 75,889 licenses behind what we were in 2008. I'll go back up to resident hunting, that 0.68%, that represents almost 4,700 resident hunting licenses that were ahead. Non-resident hunting, that percentage looks pretty bad, 16.68 in the hole. The number of non-resident hunting licenses that we were buying, the actual count is 6,225. I've already given you the fishing number. The non-resident fishing, that negative 7.3%, represents 3,600 non-resident fishing licenses that were behind compared to 08. Combination licenses were down by about 1%. That represents about 6,163 licenses behind 2008. So if we go down and make that same comparison to 2009, that other 2.77%, that represents about 1,066 licenses ahead, that were ahead over 2009. The 1.21% to resident hunting represents 8,300 licenses ahead. The non-resident hunting, that negative 3%, represents 980 licenses behind 2009. Resident fishing, that negative 7%, represents 31,594 fishing licenses that were behind the 2009 level. That negative 7.8% represents 3,905 licenses that were behind. And the last one, combination 0.62 negative, were about 3,608 combination licenses behind 2009. This next slide gives a synopsis, a graphic of where we're comparing, how we're performing for the biennial revenue estimate. At the last meeting, we talked briefly about what that means. The comptroller comes out January before of each legislative session, and her staff presents a BRE, a biennial revenue estimate, against which we are measured. And typically, they don't officially adjust or change that. Although some agencies can get minor exceptions, they don't change that publication, those figures. So that's what we're measured against by the LBB and by other oversight entities. The revenue estimate that we were given, the first line, game, fish, and water safety, represents Fund 9. And the second one, State Park Fund, represents Fund 64. The third line, local park fund, represents Fund 467. The other category is made up of a number of different accounts, including some artificial reef donation money, and it also includes the lifetime license endowment fund. If we look at the actual revenues that were collected and the percentage that we're at, in Fund 9, the game, fish, and water safety, we're above, this represents 50% of the year elapsed. We're above 50% due to the fee increase that we had for licenses that was placed into effect September 1st. And this also represents a $3.9 million influx of revenue from an oil and gas lease bonus from a WMA Chaparral. That's in that figure as well. One of the reasons that the growth is not going to be as fast as we'd like is the BRE estimate from the Comptroller's Office has a very high estimate for oil and gas royalties and for interest. And we also, I've showed you the slide before for the boat and motor sales and use tax. And that is not growing as quickly as we'd like because people just aren't selling the boats. But we're okay for Fund 9. We're at 57% received, 50% of the year's elapsed. The biggest challenge on this graphic is probably going to be the second line, Fund 64. We knew that was going to be a challenge coming into this year. Because of the BRE estimate, where they had very high estimates again on oil and gas royalties and on the interest. We did have $1.1 million collected from the Trinity River Authority for the Cedar Hill State Park. That's reflected in these figures. And for right now, the poor second quarter we had for state park revenue is probably keeping that from increasing too. But I expect that that's going to change in March and in the summer months, the peak months for state parks fee revenue. That makes up part of that second line as well. The third line, local park fund, that's above average right now due to about $2.8 million in federal funds that's been collected year to date through February 28th. And that very last line, we're doing great. It represents primarily a donation to the artificial reef fund, and it also includes about $3.2 million in lifetime license funds. The next two slides, I'm going to give you a real high-level summary of the operating budget. Each month, we try to get to you as soon as we can a copy of the monthly financial report. I think the monthly financial report, effective through February 28th, probably was sent out March 9th. I know Commissioner Duggins received it, and I hope the rest of you did. And this kind of gives you a snapshot of where we've moved from December through February 28th. We had a number of budget adjustments that took place. Most of them were small. We had an influx of federal funds. And when you see the line up there that's grants, most of that is representative of federal funding that came into the agency, a $3.5 million. And Rich mentioned earlier some UVs. UVs happen throughout the year. Federal funds have also UV authority. So we have 823 that was UV'd in. And we had some donations. On the UV amounts, we had some federal grants come in that were UV'd $645,000. We had a small piece of old UV construction of about $145,000. The only comment that I'd like to note on this slide is this does not yet reflect the general obligation bond issuance of $38 million, because that was just barely approved. Rich mentioned that to you in his presentation on UVs and construction. So next time we convene and go over the budget, you're going to see an adjustment to increase the budget by an additional $38 million to reflect the GO bonds. I think TPFA this week has issued the commercial paper, and that funding is now available for us to begin planning. The very last slide I have for you breaks down the budget by object of expense or different types of budget categories on a very high level. And as I mentioned before, the two largest categories for the department are basically our personnel costs, our salary and other, that includes fringe. Our adjusted budget has gone to $151.4 million. And the second largest item, which includes the UVs that Rich talked about earlier, is the capital expenditures. That includes construction and as well as a number of other capital items, $133.2 million. This represents 50% of the year complete with 50% to go. So the percent remaining, we're healthy. We still have 64.3% of our budget remaining. I think we're in good shape, but we're also anticipating future instructions for the legislative appropriations request that's probably going to affect us more in the future than with our current year and next fiscal year. But there's no telling. When we get the instructions, we'll share them with the executive office and they'll share them with you, so that we can give you an analysis of we think the impact is going to be at that time. I just don't know when we're going to get those instructions. That's the presentation I have for you on the budget and the revenue side. I'd be happy to answer any questions, if you have any, or defer them to Julie or Lance, because they're pretty sharp.
Any questions or discussion?
Straightforward.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen.
Spring and summer.
Committee item number three is a natural agenda update. Ms. Julie Horsley.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Julie Horsley. I'm in the Planning and Analysis section in the Administrative Resources Division, and I'll be discussing updates to our strategic plan, which is also known as the natural agenda. Just as a bit of explanation, the natural agenda is different from the land and water plan that was recently revised, in that it is more of a legislative strategic plan that establishes our budget structure and identifies anticipated funding needs. We do make an effort to link the two plans as closely as possible, and I'll discuss that a little bit more as we go through the slides. Just to start off with a little bit of background, the requirement for strategic planning was established by the legislature in 1991. Provisions of the government code require all state agencies to engage in a strategic planning process and to prepare and submit a five-year plan every 2 years. The statute, as well as more specific instructions that are issued by the LBB and Governor's Office, lay out the basic elements that have to be included in all agency strategic plans. These include things like a mission statement and philosophy, an internal and external assessment, and as well as goals, objectives, strategies, and performance measures. The goals, objectives, and strategies set forth in the strategic plan form the budget structure for each agency and serve as the framework for requesting funding from the legislature through our legislative appropriations request. There are also other sections of the strategic plan, the actual text, that are used to kind of serve as a preview of potential exceptional items that will be included in the legislative appropriations request as well. In terms of due dates and processes, these are pretty much dictated by the LBB and the Governor's Office. Any proposed structure changes have to be submitted to the LBB and the Governor's Office by April 16th. Once submitted, there's usually a series of meetings where we review and negotiate the changes, and final approval of those structure changes rests with those offices. Then the final strategic plan document, which includes the approved structure as well as the other elements, is due July 2nd. Our process here relies very heavily on input that we receive from the various divisions. We began asking for division input into possible measure and structure changes back in January, and I'll be reviewing the submissions that were submitted in the next couple of slides. Divisions are also providing feedback regarding updates and changes to other sections of the natural agenda. So regarding our proposed structure changes, overall, we're asking for revisions to a total of seven strategies. The most significant set of changes affects our existing fisheries and management, fisheries management and hatchery operation strategies in both inland and coastal fisheries divisions. Right now, each division has two separate strategies. One addresses, you know, management, and the other is hatchery operations. And the proposal is to consolidate those two so that each division just has one strategy. The main motivation behind this consolidation is to allow us to address changing funding needs in these areas more easily and more efficiently and without concern about running into transferability limitations. We're also requesting some relatively minor revisions to strategy wording for wildlife, communications, and law enforcement strategies. Those are mainly for clarification and cleanup purposes. In terms of our performance measures, we're asking for deletion of a total of 6 measures. Two of these are existing state park minor repair measures that will actually be replaced with what we consider to be more meaningful indicators. The other 4 are measures of our land acquisition function. These measures are tied to some very specific information that was included in the land and water plan. With the recent revisions to that plan, that information no longer exists. Which is why we feel justified and that it's appropriate to request deletion of these. We're also requesting addition of 4 new state parks measures. 3 of these relate to state parks minor repair program and are an effort to implement some of the recommendations that were in the state park system study, which was required by the 80th legislature. Then the other measure addition would capture information on the number of persons entering state parks free of charge. This would complement one of the existing measures that we have, which is number of paid park visits. And then finally, we're requesting revisions to a total of approximately 50 existing measures. These are, for the most part, very non-substantive in nature, minor changes to the definitions. There's just a couple that I would like to point out to you just because they're a little bit more significant. One is percent of private land acreage in Texas managed to enhance wildlife. We're proposing changing the way we measure that so that we're using the total land acreage as opposed to private land acreage. And the other is the number of state parks in operation. We would be proposing a new methodology so that the measure would be based on a count of state park units rather than based on deed information. And that count of state park units would be something that we would bring to the commission for approval. In addition to the structure and measure changes, we're also currently working on updating the actual text of the natural agenda, including sections outlining key events, legislative initiatives, and strategic priorities. It will be in this section, the strategic priority section, that we link the natural agenda and the land and water plan. Similar to how we laid this out last time, the section is going to be arranged according to major land and water plan goal, and then underneath those we'll lay out the issues and challenges we're facing and the key accomplishments in achieving that goal. We will plan to provide you with more details on these sections at the next commission meeting, and hopefully by that point we'll have a draft ready for circulation and review. Once comments from the review have been incorporated, the final plan must then be approved and signed by the executive director and the chairman. And as I mentioned earlier, the final plan will then be submitted by the July 2nd deadline. That concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Fun stuff.
I'm glad you
and you
got
to blend it too, don't you?
Committee item number 4, Julie, I think you also have this.
Yes. For the record, my name is Julie Horsley. This item consists of a number of different fee items that affect multiple divisions. In the interest of time, rather than having each individual division come up to the table, I'll be presenting all of them
please.
For your consideration.
I was looking at a couple of them. One of them for $5 or something.
I'm sorry.
No, we have to do it. I mean, go ahead.
In the event that you do have any specific questions on any of the items, I'll be deferring to the staff that are available in the audience. The first item is a cleanup affecting the grass park permit fee. Currently, all fee amounts for licenses and permits are located in Chapter 53 of our rules. We recently discovered an outdated fee reference for the grass park permit, in Chapter 57 and are proposing deletion of that obsolete reference. In addition, since the time we prepared this agenda item, we noticed a couple of other instances of outdated fee items listed in other sections, and would like to request authority to correct these items as part of this proposal as well. The second item deals with fees for department-sponsored events. From time to time, the department sponsors special activities or events and charges a fee to either partially defray or recover the cost of hosting that event. The proposed amendment would more clearly authorize imposition of such fees by providing generic authority to recover costs for these types of events. The third item relates to fees charged for bat viewing at the Old Tunnel Wildlife Management Area. Regulations currently provide a variety of fee ranges for visitors wanting to access the lower viewing areas, and those fee ranges are based on age or group type. To simplify fee collection and bookkeeping, the proposed amendment would implement a flat $5 fee regardless of age or group type. And as I mentioned, the fee is for access to the lower viewing area only. Access to the upper viewing area would still be free of charge. And then the final item relates to deer breeder permit renewal fees. Senate Bill 1586, which was passed last session, requires the Parks and Wildlife Department to work with the Texas Animal Health Commission to develop a shared database of deer breeder information. The bill also specified that the two agencies should provide incentives, including reduced fees, to deer breeders whose cooperation results in reduced costs or increased efficiencies. This proposal would reduce the permit renewal fee for deer breeders who file at least 85% of their required information electronically. The reduced fee would be $200 as compared to $400. We expect that this will encourage more deer breeders to use the electronic reporting system and result in greater efficiencies and lower costs to administer the program. The 85% criteria was selected to account for the fact that there may be factors beyond the control of deer breeders that might require them to submit information via hard copy or over the telephone.
So, for instance, our system may go down and shouldn't be penalized for that when they've got to fax it in.
Okay. I was trying to figure out how to get it with 85%.
Thank you for your time. That concludes this presentation.
Thank you. And thank you for doing the work. It's, I was kind of kidding, but especially the work that you do working with the legislature and the LBB and all of that. I mean, obviously, that sets the tone for everything we do starting with the next legislature. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Any discussion?
I think the reduction in the fee is too significant for the, because we're still going to have costs. I'm serious. Didn't you and I discuss this?
Well, we better have a discussion about it. You think it's too much? I assume we can. We publish all this stuff.
For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood, Whitetail Deer Program Leader and Interim Big Game Program Director. I'd like to tell you, Commissioner, that we have some wonderful formula and a lot of data to support that figure of $200. When in reality, I really can't defend $200 over $175 over $225. But I will say that a staff in our wildlife permits office actually documents the time they spend on each activity for each deer breeder quite well. And they have a pretty good idea of how much of their time goes towards actual data entry versus other issues they deal with in this program. And what we're hoping to accomplish, among other things, but mainly with this proposal, is to eliminate as much data entry as possible, which consumes quite a bit of time. And based on the notes that they keep for each record, it's a pretty close estimate, I believe, that approximately, on average, approximately 50% of the time they spend working through deer breeder records and renewing deer breeder permits is with data entry. So we're hoping that if we can reduce that amount of work that they do for each deer breeder, that could justify a 50% reduction in cost.
Well, my observation is that, first of all, was the fee of $400 appropriate or too low? And I'm not saying either way, but I think you could argue that the amount of time that we spend on it, that $400 is probably lower than the amount of time staff spends within the 2 years.
Actually,
and number two, you're talking about a 50% reduction in the fee when they still get to they get that reduction by Purdue submitting 85% instead of 100% of them. So the math there doesn't work.
Okay, I'd like to address both of those, and I might forget one of them as I go, so help me stay on track if you would. But the 85%, in theory, what we're shooting for here is 100% data entry by deer breeders. And what our data is showing us from the few deer breeders that are currently using the online system now, there's several breeders that are registered, in fact 391, but 15% of those people have only logged in one time, ever, so they're not using it. Another 10% have only logged in twice, so they're not really using it. But what we have observed is people are either using it or they're not. If they're using it at all, they're using it for everything. But there are times when it is actually the department's fault for where we have to make edits to records, which when we make the way we have this old system designed, and I'll just say real quickly that we are evolving into a new system and going to tie this into our TWIMS online system, but that's a couple of years out. So we are operating with a system that's being held together with a bunch of Band-Aids right now. And I'm getting a bad habit of this today. losing my train of thought. I really have forgotten now. Maybe you can refresh my memory with a question.
Most of the users are using their online to 100%
of the time. Oh, that's correct. Thank you. They're using it for 100% of the time. And so what we're finding is if somebody's going to use this system for 50%, if they do 50% of their work in it, they're doing 100% of their work in it. But where I was going a minute ago is that there are, at no fault to the breeder, but actually at fault to the department, at times where we have to make edits to their records. And when we run this query to see who actually did the work, it's going to show that Parks and Wildlife did the work and penalized the breeder. And it's our fault. And I'll just give you one example. There was a time a few years ago where we made a mistake and we issued duplicate unique ID numbers to a bunch of deer, to a couple of cooperators. So of course they weren't unique at that point. And by the time we found our error, it was too late. And these deer are out there. They've changed hands, other people have them. And so a new breeder could receive these deer today, and we identify where there's an error on our part. It, again, is no fault of the breeder currently in possession of those deer. So we feel very comfortable that this 85% figure will more than cover those situations. Could we have said 90%? Maybe. That's kind of like what I said about the fee, whether it's 175, 200, or 225. The 85% could probably be negotiated as well, but I feel comfortable that we won't penalize any breeders for that, with that expectation, knowing that if they're really doing 85%, they're going to do 100% based on what we've observed so far.
And the $400, you think, is fully recovers our costs on the...
Thank you for reminding me of that. Currently, we do have good data today, whereas we really didn't have very good data when we changed the fee to $400. Law enforcement has changed the way they code. We code specifically to that permit as well. And we're certainly recovering our costs today. In fact, as we move forward with this new TWIM system over the next 2 years, there's some programming costs associated with that. And this $400 fee, actually, based on the way all time is coded today, with law enforcement and wildlife, This fee will cover the cost needed for programming this new system as well.
That partially addressed my question, but I'm, and maybe you said it, Mitch, and I didn't hear it, but are we currently collecting more information, more data about these permittees than electronically than we would if it's non-electronic, you know, if it's sent in?
The information we collect from them, whether it's in hard copy or electronic, is the same information.
So the hope is through the new system we'd be able to collect more information.
No, sir, I don't think I'd say that. It's the same information, but it would save us a tremendous amount of time to where we can finally get caught up in the deer breeder program and begin taking a lot of our efforts, our fixed costs that we have in the deer breeder program now, and apply it to some other permitting programs.
I probably didn't say it right. So through the new system that we're developing, do you see an opportunity to collect more data and more information than we're currently collecting from deer breeders?
We certainly could. We could build in the business.
We have more flexibility to do that.
If we built those into our business requirements, which we're working on right now, we certainly could. I can't think of any additional information that we'd be interested in collecting, but we could.
I have a question. A while ago, you said that we were having to input data that was being sent incorrectly. So are we assuming that if it's going to be sent electronically, it's all going to be correct and we're not going to have to fix any of that?
That's a very good question. A lot of the, right now we're at 85% of renewing permits that should have been renewed last summer. In fact, their reports were due May 15th, and we still have 15% of those reports we have not renewed. And a big reason for that is because of the errors that are in there. And when our staff enter these data and the database says, well, there's an error, then naturally they take that and they have to put it aside so they can work on the next person and not hold up their permit any longer than necessary. And so this stack begins to build over time. And as you know, once you do that, then it takes quite a bit more time to eventually dive back into it and start over. What happens if a user enters the data and the database shows the user that there's an error, the user right then can track down the source of that error and correct it himself. And so that would save us a tremendous amount of time of getting on the phone, calling this breeder and that breeder that he did business with and this breeder. We can just lay that responsibility on the breeder himself, because for him to be able to qualify to enter all his data online, it has to be accurate. So we can then lay that responsibility on accurate data being entered on the user.
So why don't you just send it back and say your information is incomplete, please finish?
That sounds.
If I send a bill to an insurance company, they don't finish it out for me. They send it back to me, and they don't pay me until I've made absolutely sure, or they're comfortable with the data in there. So why are we having to finish out applications and call people around? I don't understand that.
I didn't either for a long time, and I can't tell you that I still do completely. What happens when we notify deer breeders by mail that they have some errors, and we actually tell them specifically what those errors are, it is not uncommon for it to be several months later before we realize we still haven't received the corrections and we need to do a follow-up. Much of the problem that we have right now is with not a high percentage. Right now, again, we're looking at about 15%. And about 65 deer breeders from previous years that still don't have current permits, that simply do not respond. But hopefully
don't renew the permits. Boy, how did you get response right quick? I don't understand why we're doing somebody else's work.
I'll let Clayton.
Commissioner, for the record, Clayton Wolf, I was just trying to think of some examples where the permittee has an error, but it's no fault of theirs. And the difference between the electronic data entry that a permittee does is there's a reconciliation process that takes place in the database if they're doing it online to authenticate that that's the right number coming from that permittee at that time. But those folks that are still doing things on paper, if an individual sells a deer to someone else, they give them the unique ID number, and there's no way of them authenticating that. So someone could legitimately, and with a good faith effort, purchase a deer, they take the number, they write it down, they report it. Then when they turn it into us and we actually enter it in the database, that's when the database tells us that's not the right number. That number should not come from that deer. So then when we call that individual, they say, well, that's the number they gave me. So then we have to track it. And sometimes we may be following a deer through two or three individuals because it was poorly tattooed. And so the source of the error is not necessarily the last person that reported it. It could be one or two generations back. And so often now we do have people that if the source of the error or if they're just not compliant or not reporting, we do have a process where we send them letters and we say, you get this fixed or we're going to be yanking your permit. So it's a hodgepodge, but the problem is we had thousands upon thousands of deer that were traded across the state for many years simply in paper, and there were errors resident in that paperwork all over the place. And it wasn't until several years ago when we decided we were going to have a database reconcile these records automatically. So that's the benefit also to getting somebody online, is if they get online, then the computer won't allow them to enter a transaction that's not valid. And so it's also going to cut down on the number of errors that we receive.
So why are we having to keep track of the individual animals that are sold by a business person out there someplace?
We're tracking the animals for disease management purposes. Back with the discovery of CWD around 2000 east of the Mississippi, there was a lot of concern about animals being brought into Texas or moved across the United States. And you also had things like TB and mad cow disease, and ag agencies and wildlife agencies all together were looking at these animal movements. In fact, the federal government there was really a big push several years ago for a national animal ID system that you may be aware of, where there's a unique identifier. The purpose is if you come up with an animal that has a reportable disease, whether it's tuberculosis or whatever, you need to know where that animal came from so that you don't implicate everyone that's involved in that trade. You basically go to the source. And so that unique identification system basically is equivalent to the National Animal ID System that we use, so that we can track an animal so that if we find tuberculosis, foot and mouth disease, or CWD, we actually know where that animal went.
Or came from,
right, and all the parties that might be implicated. And at that point, we'd bring in Texas Animal Health Commission, and they would issue hold orders on those properties, and there would be a lockdown until we figured out which parties might be involved and which may not, which parties could enter back into commerce. It is a very data intensive permit. It is our most. That's why I think Mitch made the comment. He's not sure what else we could gather, because of all our permittees, this is the most data intensive permit we have.
Maybe I can continue this after, because I know everybody's starting at the end of the day, so I'll just talk to you.
You bet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Ralph, can you live with the dollars amounts? I mean, because the overall dollars don't change much. You're talking about maybe $10,000 versus $20,000 or something. It's not a lot of dollars overall. I understand your issue, but do you want to change?
Yeah, I live with it. I just question that we're really going to achieve the savings that you think you are because of the issue you're talking about. I think you're still going to see errors that are going to require staff time, and you're going to end up going in the hole by cutting it as much as you're talking about cutting it. But if you don't think that's the case, I'll rely on your judgment.
Well, and then one thing I will tell you, and Mitch is right, we're having to do some level of estimation here, but we do track our time, and if we see down the road that our estimates were wrong, we would surely come back and propose a different fee structure. Because our intent is not to add any financial burden to the agency.
And push this to try to create incentive.
Yes,
we need this to go electronic. Like,
I would say to you,
need to start telling them, the next year or 2 years, it's going all electronic.
All this is contingent upon how many people decide to go from paper to online.
Our revenue continues to increase annually, and the number of permittees we have has been increasing 20% annually for the last several years. And we do expect our fixed costs to go down and start to shift some of this effort that we're putting into this program into some of the other permitting programs that are even farther behind on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we will see a reduction in cost eventually. It could be that this first year there's some more time that goes into training some of these people on how to use the online system. There may be some time that we're not anticipating. We'll find out.
If anything's data intensive, should be electronic. You need to push them to that.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. All should be electronic.
One more item, Mr. Chairman, and then we'll be done.
You got the tail end this time, right?
Mr. Chairman, will you authorize us to get permission to publish in the Texas Register?
I certainly make that recommendation.
Thank you.
And committee item number 5, the audit reports. Mr. Contreras, thank you.
Good afternoon, commissioners. For the record, my name is Carlos Contreras. I'm the director of internal audit. Back at the start of this fiscal year, Scott Borah from Walt Dabney and I had some conversations about trying to limit the focus of the state park audits that we were going to perform this year, given the fact that we had a requirement from the state auditor's office to go and review the parks in 08 and 09. Given that, we mutually agreed we would audit half of the parks each year so that we would go through the parks in our formal risk assessment completely in a two-year period. So given that, we had 86 state parks in our formal risk assessment, of which this fiscal year we conducted 42 audits, 42 parks. We did the work in 7 rounds of 6 parks apiece, and our criteria was the same as in previous years. It was a compliance with the fiscal control and visitation reporting plan. This year, what we did was we went back to some of the parks that had been compliant in 08 and 09 early on, and we also went to some of the parks that we didn't visit during fiscal year 08 and 09. Another thing that we added was that the test weeks weren't announced to the parks until the audit team was on site.
Good.
Now, the results of the audits, we conducted 42. 35 of the parks were compliant with the fiscal control and visitation reporting plans. 6 of the parks were ranked as least severe. We didn't have any parks that were moderately severe or in the most severe category. The one outlier was Perry Haynes Ranch. We did perform an audit of the facility, but we didn't rank it. And there were some extenuating circumstances for that. That was due to the fact that there was a transfer of Perry Haynes Ranch to the State Parks Division on 9-1 from the Communications Division. And the facility really didn't have their management team in place at the time. So we did the audit. We didn't rank it, but we provided the results to Rodney Franklin, who's the regional director, and to the park superintendent. And as far as state park audits, that were complete for this year, the overall compliance rate was over 85%.
Wonderful. Okay. We're getting there, huh, Carlos?
Yes, sir.
And Walt?
Other projects that we have currently, and I expect to get, you'll be seeing a lot of these reports coming up in the next few weeks. We have in the reporting stage an audit of the accounts payable function. We also have, and this report was released yesterday, both internally and externally, and that's Texas Administrative Code Chapter 202. It's a compliance review. The TAC 202 are the information security standards that are applicable to all state agencies. So that was a baseline of a compliance that we did for IT. We've been conducting law enforcement cash handling audits. We did that in two rounds. We conducted one round in February, each of nine offices. That report should be coming out in the next few weeks. The second round, we've conducted our field work, and we're in the review process currently. And you'll probably see that report out sometime in late April. We have two audits that we are starting. One of them is an audit of selected federal grants in the planning process. We plan to have an entrance conference next week for that. Not only is it a review of compliance for federal grants, but it's also we are going to examine the agency's internal control structure and processes that are in place to handle these grants. So we're going to look at the grant process from the time that there's the actual application for it and the approval process through the agency, and all the way into the work, the coordination with administrative resources and the tracking for various financial oversight bodies. The second audit, and that we just kicked off last week. We had our entrance conference, and this is an audit of IT general controls over selected division applications. The three applications that we chose were TLC, BRITS, and the law enforcement system. And IT general controls, it's also going to involve the IT division, Georgia shop, and the coordination that they have with IBM under the data consolidation services.
Your favorite.
Some additional assignments. We completed the Public Funds Information Act compliance review, which is a mandated review examines whether the agency had any investments that they made. I can just tell you that right now, that it was more of a formality. My predecessor has decided to continue with that compliance review for the fact that even though the controller is the one that is the agency that houses our funds, and there's really no investments, even though we do have an investment officer. The second is we provided some on-site assistance to Internal Affairs for the work that was conducted in one of the law enforcement offices in East Texas. I wanted to talk a little bit about the follow-up process. Institute of Internal Auditors, we have a performance standard stating that we must have a follow-up process to monitor and ensure that management actions are taken to implement our recommendations, or that senior management has accepted the risk of not taking any actions to mitigate those risks. So the process that we've set up will be conducted every 6 months, beginning in April and in October. We'll start contacting the division's responsible parties and management via email. We will provide within that email a matrix where the responsible parties can supply a narrative, and they can also supply us with supporting documentation so that we can assess the level of implementation of each of the recommendations. We'll take a look at it. We'll work with the individual divisions and determine the progress of the implementation. And the follow-up process continues until successful implementation, or there's mitigation by other means, or acceptance of the risk. And after we perform this follow-up in April and October, I should have a report to show you where we are, where we stand on the individual recommendations from the audits that have been conducted. And finally, there are two initiatives that we're undertaking, and these are due to a new professional standard that we have on governance. The first one is going to be an assessment our office is going to make as to whether information technology governance sustains and supports PPWD strategies and objectives. Originally, we had planned to do an audit of this, but in conversations with George Rios and IT, internally, the agency is making some changes to the Information Technology Steering Committee and some of the governance processes. So rather than conduct an audit, what we are going to do is we're going to make this assessment, gather this information and supporting documentation, and we're going to throw it into the mix for the upcoming audit plan.
and see how it rises there in the scoring to see whether we do conduct an audit. But rather than go in now, I think we need to give IT some time, IT and management some time to affect those changes if they want to. The second is an evaluation of the design, implementation, and effectiveness of our ethics-related objectives, programs, and activities. And I've been in contact with Ann Bright, our general counsel, and spoken to her briefly about that. My idea on proceeding with this is probably be we'll develop a survey and conduct a survey and use that that information from the survey to provide some recommendations or as far as, you know, taking a look at policies, taking a look at the coordination between ethics, fraud, waste, and abuse, and tone at the top, things of that nature.
On ethics, you're talking about compliance, those kinds of things relative to
ethics. Yes, sir. Compliance, what kind of programs we have, you know, I think really critical is the tone at the top. You know,
I'm worried about that.
Yeah. it's probably better. It's not really a quantifiable thing, really easily quantifiable. It's more of a subjective thing, so a survey probably works better.
Well, that's why,
a straight audit.
I guess what I'm asking, yeah, okay. And I guess somewhat you'd work with HR maybe on that, because as you said, it's more of a subjective type survey.
Yes, sir.
It's almost one of those 360s or something. Okay.
Okay. That concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
I just thank you so much for your hard work.
Is that customary for an audit? It's not a criticism. Is that customary for an auditor to get into what the chairman was just asking about? It seemed to me the HR or HR center. What are the ethics guidelines?
Yeah. Well, this is a new standard that just came out at the beginning of this year. And
state imposed or
oh, no,
gas thing?
No, it's the Institute of Internal Auditors. It's our professional practices framework.
Okay.
Yeah, they put that out there. One section looks at the IT governance and whether it supports or sustains our mission. The second is the evaluation of the ethics programs and policies. And then the third has to do with consulting activities. We don't really perform a lot of consulting. We don't perform any consulting activities here, per se. So it's the two areas that I pointed out that are new. And to be quite honest with you, this is new for the audit community. So we're also, this is a learning process for us. Different agencies have addressed these requirements in different manners. You know, it's really a learning process for our profession right now.
Thank you. Great. Congratulations on the parks to you and Wald and all your regional guys and everybody, because I know it's been... Now we're going to put the new system in place. It's coming almost like starting over again. Isn't it? Oh, well. That's why we all have gray hair in there. At least we have some hair.
We did.
I'm not picking on anybody, but I'm losing it like crazy. And I think the parks has been half of it, Walt. I'm teasing you guys. I'm trying to get a little lightning. We need a little levity here. God almighty. It's been all going today, all day long. Anyway, appreciate it, Carlos. And I'm glad to see the progression. It's been tremendous.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, this committee has completed this business.
God, I get to do this. We're adjourned!